Hello and welcome to the MMQB Monday Morning NFL Podcast. I'm your host, Gary Gramling. A little bit of a change up this week. I don't know. I don't want to say going to the bench. We're mixing up the depth chart, maybe? is this Tua coming on for Ryan Fitzpatrick right now? Jenny Brentis is in this week. Connor Orr is out, probably for a little while. I think Jenny's going to be here for a while, if I'm being perfectly honest. But Jenny, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. I mean, the Connor-Ryan Fitzpatrick comparison works only to the extent that they both have fantastic beards.
Yes, absolutely. Physically, basically twins. But yeah, Connor will still be around most of the time. He might miss a week or so on the Weak Side podcast, but Jenny will still be there. We'll still have all the usual stuff going on. I just don't want anyone to freak out when they're listening to the show for Connor, and Connor's not here.
It's a big change, and I have big shoes to fill. So
it's going to be just as good, probably much, much better. And I hope Connor didn't hear that. Don't want to hurt his feelings, but we have week 10 Sunday action to go through here. Week 11 is next week. Week 10 Sunday action. This was a wild weather week, and we're going to start with probably the craziest weather game, and that was a Sunday nighter, Patriots-Ravens. I mean, look, everyone had sort of written the Patriots obit, squeaking by the Jets on Monday Night Football last week, did not do anything to get anyone back on the New England bandwagon. And yet here we are, back-to-back wins, including this big upset as a touchdown underdog against the Ravens. And they did it their way. They did it how they did it early in the season with the run game and, a 2-to-1 run-pass ratio here. And we all kind of thought, like, okay, this is a formula that works for this team. And then it didn't for a little while. And now it's working again.
Yeah, and to your point about the weather being crazy, Gary, the New York broadcasts on NBC, they cut in for the tornado warning during one of the Ravens' first scores, and I was thinking, oh my gosh, this is going to be a bad night, and it just got progressively worse from there, because presumably the system that was causing the tornado warning in New York quickly moved up to Foxborough, or maybe was it part of a large red blob on the radar. I'm not exactly sure the direction that the weather was moving, but it was just wild to be hearing tornado warning in New York. I live on the 7th floor of an apartment, and just the wind was whipping around. And then seeing the game being played, obviously the progression to the end of the fourth quarter was crazy. But yeah, I mean, this felt like we were waiting for a performance that would say, don't count the Patriots out. And maybe it came a little bit too late. Certainly last week against the Jets made it feel like, okay, maybe it's not coming. But yeah. I just felt like after the absence, Newton's absence from being placed on the COVID-19 list, that ultimately they would find their footing again. It just happened a little bit later than expected.
Yeah, and they're sitting at 4-5 right now, and there are so many 6-3 teams in the AFC, including the Ravens now. The Patriots are still sitting, they're in 10th in the AFC, they're two games back, and there's just a lot of teams they have to leapfrog at this point, assuming it's going to be a 14-team playoff this year, and we won't have the shortened season and that contingency plan that the NFL has now laid out. But you just kind of look back, it's like, that Seattle game, they're on the goal line if they go in there. In Buffalo, Cam loses the fumble when it looks like they might be going in for a winning score. At the very least, a tying field goal at the end of that game. You just flip one or two of those games. And you can say that about a lot of teams. But you flip one or two of those games, and this whole season has a much different feel for the Patriots right here. But, yeah, this was their kind of game. The Ravens' offense, and I guess the first thing we'll say is the way the rain was coming down on the final series, I wouldn't have blamed Lamar Jackson if he just sort of shrugged his shoulders with like 30 seconds left and was just like, nah, we can't go anywhere in this. This is not whether you can move the ball 80 yards in. So, but the Ravens were a little bit disjointed again offensively, and again, weather played into it. The Patriots are still, it's still a Belichick team, and they've got issues at linebacker, but they're still pretty solid, up front. They are, no Stephon Gilmore, but do the Ravens really have the outside weapons to hurt you when there's no Stephon Gilmore? Maybe not quite. A little bit of another uneven performance here for the Baltimore offense. I don't know. I'm not I guess I'm just not terribly worried about it yet.
You're not worried about it for the Ravens,
you mean? Yeah, yeah.
Okay, interesting. I'm a little worried, Gary, I have to say. Yeah, because I feel like going from the performance that Jackson had last season and the way that the Titans game played out with their game plan, I felt like in Lamar Jackson's second season as a starter, he took a big step forward in his passing ability, and that ultimately resulted in the MVP campaign. This season, I felt like it was a lot on the coaches to continue to advance and develop that system, be prepared for the adjustments that were coming from defenses. And I think you can look at this offense and wonder, have they really done that? Now, there have been a lot of changes. The offensive line is a big one. There's been some big losses from what they had on the offensive line last season. And also, you know, trading away Hurst, you know, the ability of these multiple tight end packages was such a huge part of the Ravens offense last season. So I just wonder if they have, you know, if they've made enough adjustments or if they've advanced the offense enough from in terms of play calling and scheme from where it was last year.
The one thing, and now I'm worried that you're worried, but the one thing I'll put out there, Nick Boyle was lost for the season in this game. And look, no one's mistaking Nick Boyle for young Mike Ditka or something. But Nick Boyle was a big deal in their run game. He's a big deal with what they do as far as getting the multiple tight ends on the field, getting an opposing defense in their base alignment, which, nobody builds around having three linebackers on the field anymore or anything like that. Everyone builds for their nickel and their sub package stuff. So when you can get other teams to have to go big against you, that's usually an advantage. So no Nick Boyle. It's down to Mark Andrews. And Mark Andrews is doing a much better job blocking this year than he did in his first two seasons. But they are going pretty far down that tight end depth chart at this point. And like I said, you saw it last night. They're just not really difference makers on the outside in this receiving core. I mean, Willie Snead's doing a decent job in the slot. You can do some things with Marquise Brown. Miles Boykin is still not really quite there yet. But I noticed a stat doing some research on the Ravens offense last week. They have not drawn a defensive pass interference call all season, and they only drew two last season. They just don't have those physical guys on the outside who are going to, if not make a play on the ball, go through someone and draw a flag or something like that. That's just not what the offense is. And it doesn't look like it's going to become that this season.
That's a really good point, Gary. Yeah. Because I was thinking that this year we'd see Marquise Brown, that deep ball connection between Jackson and Brown, take a step forward, but he isn't that physical guy. And I think in an offense like this, you do kind of need that physical outside threat, which they don't have.
Well, maybe Dez Bryant comes up. Maybe he finds the fountain of youth and they get something. Just anything going there. Any sort of threat outside the numbers would be a big improvement at this point. But I don't know. There's also, when I look at it, I always think look, they were historically good last year. They were probably going to fall off, certainly in the ground game to some extent. And like you mentioned, no Marshall Yanda this year. Now Ronnie Stanley's out for the year. Mm-hmm. It's a different team up front. And we'll see what they do going forward. One of the things I sort of highlighted in what I wrote this weekend was in terms of red zone, which tends to be very fickle week to week, year to year, it's almost a random stat, but they're way down in their red zone efficiency. They've lost some turnovers in the red zone. If that stuff doesn't happen, you look a little bit better. And look, they've faced Steelers, Colts, Patriots right in a row. Those are three tough defenses they faced. But it's going to be interesting. It's going to be interesting how they try and figure this out with, again, another tight end out, really no answers coming at the receiver spot. And what do they do going forward?
And you put in the show notes here smartly, Gary, the wildcat call on a fourth down, which we obviously saw was a big negative play. And but that is the kind of thing that makes me a little bit worried, right? When that's your call on fourth down. And again, like there was a lot of snap exchanges that went awry last night because of all of the wet conditions. That's understandable. But those kinds of things just make me wonder just about if they're maximizing what they do have, even with some of the deficiencies this season versus last year that we've highlighted.
Are you digging a little too deep into the playbook at this point? Right. I don't get why you ever go Wildcat with Lamar as your quarterback. The whole point of going Wildcat is getting the extra man in the run game, and it's like you already have that. I'm sure Greg Roman has reasons that are better than anything I could come up with, but surprising.
Yeah, it was definitely surprising. So I mean the Steelers are running away with the AFC North at this point. And the Ravens are still in good position for a wild card playoff bid. And so things could take a good turn for them the last half of the season. They still have a lot of things in front of them, but it is kind of a stark comparison to last season. And I think perhaps this game like reinforced that. Again, the conditions are weird, and everything changes week to week in the NFL. But just comparing like the pummeling that the Ravens gave the Patriots last season versus what we saw this season.
Yeah, yeah, that also stands out a little bit. But we'll see what's going on with Baltimore from here on in. But let's go down to Arizona. This was, I mean, look. It was the play of the season, easily. It was quite frankly just one of the most impressive plays that that you'll see. Cardinals Bills, really a great game in that it was an exciting game. I thought both offenses maybe underachieved a little bit in this one until their respective final drives. But this Kyler to DeAndre Hopkins touchdown, and look, I am an objective journalist. I don't root for anyone, but I've said on the show before, I do have a soft spot for the Bills. I have a lot of friends who are Bills fans. There's part of me that enjoys seeing the Bills succeed. And as I was watching this final play, as soon as Kyler got to the sideline and it was clear he was going to be able to set up and throw, my two small children can attest to the profanity I just sort of murmured as that ball was getting let loose, but you still didn't think it was going to happen. DeAndre Hopkins, though, I mean, it's among three defenders, and I've watched it 1,000 times at this point. It's one thing to be able to just sort of perfectly time it so that you high point the ball on a throw like that, a high arcing throw from 50 yards away. But the fact that he just sort of, he doesn't get moved by the contact. He just sort of, he doesn't get knocked off of his leap or anything like that. He just, it's like nothing was going on around him. He just jumped straight up, absorbed the contact, and came down with the ball. It was breathtaking.
Yeah, it was pretty amazing, the visual, to see his two hands just sticking up among the other six hands around him. Like, they were, his hands were just like this in the center of a circle of Bills. There were DeAndre Hopkins' hands. And I agree with you, the timing. Those kinds of plays are just like baffling to me, because the idea of a quarterback being so far away and launching the ball to the exact point where the receiver is just hard to imagine having the skill to be able to do that. And we've talked about the catch, but like equally impressive was how Kyler Murray kept the play alive. He took the snap on the right hash mark. So he ran all the way across the field, and I thought it was over. Like, it just looked like nothing's, but then you could see, as you said, Gary, he's buying time. But even when he launched the ball in the air, I didn't see where people were. Like, the way that the camera angle was, I couldn't see that DeAndre Hopkins was there. I had no idea where he was throwing, if there was a Cardinals receiver that was going to be anywhere near the ball, but he was at the exact right spot. So I think it's kind of hard to debate who made the more impressive play on that one, but that was just like, I audibly gasped when it happened.
It is. It's just, I mean, look, sometimes you just get two otherworldly talents. You just go out there and connect on a play like that, and you just sort of shrug your shoulders. Again, I spent so much time looking for, like, oh, what could have Jordan Poyer have done differently here? What could Tre'Davious White have done? Mm-hmm. There's not a whole lot. I mean, I think it was Poyer came in and sort of knocked White off a little bit. More of his contact was with White than with Hopkins, but there's just not a whole lot you can do there. It's just two really talented guys making a play. This game, otherwise, I mean, look, 62 points when it's all said and done, but both offenses didn't quite do what I would have expected them to do. I mean, on one hand, look, the Bills just didn't really get anything going downfield. Their longest pass play for most of this game had been another tunnel screen to John Brown, where they beat a blitz. But Josh Allen was just sort of, and again, he is streaky. He was sort of bad streaky in this one until the final drive, and he just, you know, the switch flipped, and he just made throw after throw, including that perfect touchdown to Stephon Diggs that looked like it had won the game at that point.
Yeah, I think I have a hard time getting over Allen's streakiness, and I think that's why I continually underestimate the Bills. Sorry to all of your friends in Buffalo, Gary. I mean, in our midseason picks, I had the Dolphins winning the division just because I have a hard time with his streakiness. But I will admit that final drive was fantastic, and the fact that he had made mistakes right before that and then overcame those mistakes and seems to bounce back quickly when he does make mistakes. And then, of course, you know, had them in a great position to win, and you can't foresee that kind of Hail Mary pass. But yeah, for most of the game, I thought the offense was underachieving, and the defenses both came up with a lot of big plays. I mean, that was kind of the flip side of it.
The thing I kept on thinking about as I watched the Bills, who I just thought they were going to get. I did not think they'd be able to contain the Cardinals at this point. Mm-hmm. On Saturday, they lose their number 2 and 3 cornerbacks, Levi Wallace and Josh Norman, to COVID protocol. Dane Jackson, who is a rookie they promoted for this game, ended up playing a lot. I mean, he went down with a knee injury in the, I think it was the second quarter, and I didn't think he was going to come back. He sort of limped through the rest of the game. But, I mean, this was very much a scotch tape together secondary, and it was just like, boy, this is not the offense you want to see in that situation. But they more than held up in this one. And certainly, I mean, look, the Cardinals got a lead in the second half and just couldn't put them away at that point. And I guess you'd say it's a testament to what Sean McDermott did with this unit again, that's sort of been a little more uneven than we expected in 2020.
Yeah, I agreed with you on that, Gary. I, going into the game, seeing the players that the Bills had to leave behind in Buffalo, I thought that the Cardinals would build a lead early, and it was reverse. You know, the Bills had control of the game, but the Cardinals surged back. So, but it was entertaining from start to finish. Mm-hmm. It was a weird game. We would not have scripted any of it, but even before the wild finish, it was entertaining.
Yeah, that AFC East is now very interesting. Mm-hmm. Bills go on a bye week here. They're a half game up on the Dolphins, and of course they have the win head to head in Miami this year, which will loom large down the stretch here. But look, if the Dolphins can steal one in Buffalo later this year, that one flips, and all of a sudden the Bills are sort of fighting for their playoff lives in this just glut of three lost teams in the AFC right now. The Cardinals, however, are now in first in the NFC West because of what happened in LA. The Rams, the Rams just sort of had the Seahawks number, and we can sort of separate for a moment, and we will get back to it, but we'll separate for a moment Russell Wilson's recent struggles here, and just point out the Rams have beaten Seattle in 5 of 6 now. The one loss was on a Thursday night, now 2 Octobers ago, October 2019, where Greg Zuerlein had a chance to win it from like 44 yards and missed the kick in the end. Otherwise, it would be a 6th straight for the Seahawks here at this point. But they have Russell's number, and in this one specifically, and this is not something we saw over the course of this series so far, but Jalen Ramsey took DK Metcalf out of this game. I mean, Metcalf was a non-factor in this one, and it was because of Ramsey.
Yeah, and that was a huge difference in this game. But the fact, like you laid out, that the Rams seem to have the Seahawks number is one of those things that just makes division races really interesting.
Yeah.
For instance, it's what never happened in the AFC East, right? No, even, you know, you could say, okay, there's a dominant team, but no one seemed to have their number, right? But the NFC West, like something like this just adds a wrinkle. The Seahawks get off to a hot start, but the Rams always play well against Seattle, so you know they can make up some ground. So these are the, you know, NFC West and AFC East are the two most interesting playoff races, and they're both really good.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it's going to be, so the Seattle team, they're still sitting at 6-3. We got 3 6-3 teams in that division right now. And the poor 49ers of all teams are just not going to be in it when it's all said and done, most likely. But right now, when you look at the Seahawks offense, we know the defense can't play, and I don't think that's going to be changing in 2020. They're just going to have to score a lot of points on offense, or the option is, and look, no one wants to hear this right now, this is the let Russ cook season, and it works spectacularly for the first 7 weeks or so. The way the Seahawks played, even if you go back to the Legion of Boom games, what they did offensively is it was based in Marshawn Lynch and the power running game, and then Russ worked off of that. Chris Carson will presumably be back soon. He seems to be sort of week to week. When Chris Carson comes back, you're not going to go maybe entirely back to let's run the ball 60% of the time, but are you going to sort of move back to that, just sort of regulate this offense a little bit? Because right now, and it's tough to put a finger on it, but it's like, you know, Russ still plays a little bit off schedule, and it just seems like maybe because of what's going on defensively, maybe because of the fact that you just don't have a run game to lean on at any point. Is he trying to do too much? I hate that phrase because it's just, it doesn't really mean anything. But the one play that stood out in this game was the Seahawks had gotten a takeaway in the second quarter. They hadn't been stopping the Rams. They get a takeaway. They get Jamal Adams gets a strip sack. They have the short field. It looks like things might turn around and they might go into halftime with a lead, et cetera, et cetera. And Russ just sort of, you know, it was kind of Russ in that, he had a throw open. He had a touchdown open early in the down. He kind of, you know, he tends to play off schedule even when he doesn't have to play off schedule. That kind of happened. He starts to scramble a little bit. He ends up throwing back across his body and just sort of floats an easy interception. And instead of, you know, instead of a touchdown, they give it right back to the Rams. And it's those kinds of plays, those kinds of just ugly turnovers that are just sort of piling up for him. And again, his interception rate right now is at 3%. That's the highest of his career by a pretty wide margin. It was 1% last year. So do you ultimately just say, okay, let's go back to what we did last year. Let's see if we can keep this defense off the field as much as possible. That was a long, rambling way to just sort of not come to any sort of conclusion.
No, but I think you're exactly right, Gary. That one play did stand out as a moment where you wondered, is he trying to do too much? Because it was a 2nd and 5.
Yeah.
There was, as they pointed out on the broadcast, a lot of green ahead of him. He could have easily gotten the first down by just running those 5 yards. And instead, he chooses to throw this ill-timed pass in the end zone. And so I think that kind of gets exactly to your point of knowing that he has to score at will and put up a lot of points to win games. Does he feel the pressure in that situation? Like, well, if I just run for the first down, you know, maybe that's not enough. Let me just throw for the touchdown. I'm on the field. I've got to make it happen. And he's so used to sort of dropping those throws in the bucket and having it be so successful. I guess the other flip side to that is teams are kind of playing them a little bit differently. I don't know if that's the case, but when you don't have that strong run game, you know, and you're knowing that Russ is taking these chances in the passing game, does that change your coverages and does that give defenses a better answer when he tries to make those kinds of throws? So it could be a combination of both, but you know, you do have to wonder after being asked to score so much early in the season, how does that sort of impact the way he looks at the game, knowing that he kind of has to do it rather than it's like this all of a sudden early in the year, it felt like everything opened up and it was so exciting to watch and it was like he was playing freely. But then you do get to a point where that becomes a burden, which I have to say, Gary, you rightly predicted. You said earlier this year that the Seahawks' success was not sustainable. I wrongly thought they would figure out a way to fix the defense a little bit. Like, I just thought Pete Carroll would figure out something to fix it.
I mean, look, Carlos Dunlap is in. We'll see if he becomes a difference maker in the second half. And right now, they're. It feels like they've settled on Jamal Adams as just a guy they're going to blitz a ton. It's just sort of been weird. I mean, Jamal Adams, I know he's graded very poorly in coverage. He's also, I mean, he's been one-on-one on Stephon Diggs, on Julian Edelman. I don't think that's what you want to ask any safety in the league to do, no matter how highly you think of the guy. So I don't know if they just have to sort of go back to the drawing board and just kind of say, okay, we can't sort of use Jamal Adams as kind of a pure cornerback or a pure, you know, man coverage guy against really good receivers. And I don't know. They're running out of time to figure it out. That is for sure. On the Rams side of this thing, look, the offense was back to its sort of methodical self after that meltdown with all the turnovers in Miami against the Blitz. They end up going 9 for 15 on third down, again, playing that Seahawks Seahawks defense that just sort of does not have a pass rush, certainly will help things out there. But they do lose Andrew Whitworth in this one. As of Monday morning, it sounds like he avoided a torn ACL, which is good news. He could potentially be back for, like, the playoffs is what it sounds like. But Andrew Whitworth is out. Joseph Noteboom is in. Noteboom's a day two pick from a couple years ago. He's a raw specimen, very athletic guy, but he has not played well in limited action. It just seems like this is going to be a pretty severe downgrade at left tackle for them. And then, look, we saw last year when their offensive line wasn't right the first half of the season, they struggled to generate anything because Jared Goff is not a guy who's going to create his own space and time out there.
Yeah, I was just going to say that, Gary, that last year that was a big glaring issue in their regression from having made the Super Bowl the year prior to that. Mm-hmm. So the fact that Whitworth is out is definitely a concern. I mean, the reports are that it's an MCL, so it could be a handful of weeks. I mean, that's good news that it's not season ending. It depends on how quickly the body heals. And, you know, is he to the point where he can play at the left tackle position where you need, you know, athleticism, you need to have some mobility on that knee. But I would say that that's definitely like the biggest issue for the Rams now moving forward. I just find this team so hard to figure out. I agree, like the performance in Miami was, when you have that many turnovers, sometimes it just snowballs and then it just gets out. The game gets away from you, and this was a good reset. But they're just so up and down. Like it's hard for me to kind of like assess them this year. I sort of feel similarly to the Rams as I do about the Bills.
It's the thing about the Rams is, like, you hear about defenses over the last like decade. It's like, okay, we want to make offenses have to go on these long drives with a lot of plays, and we're going to trust that at some point they're going to make mistakes and that sort of thing. And the Rams kind of just play into that. I mean, that's kind of what they want to do. They kind of want to, it's run game. It's very horizontal. They got it downfield a little more this game. I think they had more to do with the opponent than what they are capable of doing offensively. But it's, when you want to go out there and all your scoring drivers are going to be 9 and 10 plays, I guess that's a different kind of tightrope you're walking at this point, as opposed to the old Josh Allen tightrope.
Yeah. At this point, I don't know who the favorite in the division is.
I still think it's the Rams. I always thought it was the Rams.
Okay.
It was always the Rams for me.
Okay. But. All right. Fair enough, Gary.
That's going to be a really good three-way race down the stretch.
Yes.
All right, Jenny, wait right there. We're going to bring in Michael Fabiano right now. It is time for the SI Fantasy segment, as always, presented by DraftKings. Michael Fabiano joins us once again. Fabs, we were just talking about this off air. Let's start on a down note. Let's talk about the quarterback play and early waiver wire. Is there anything we can do to rectify this after a down week for quarterbacks?
Right. So there's not a lot off the wire that I feel like is viable in competitive leagues. Let's put it that way. Mm-hmm. But Jameis Winston's going to be the top ad at quarterback because Drew Brees got hurt. He had the rib injury, had an MRI. We're hearing reports already that he's going to miss some time. And Winston was the QB5 last year. Like, I know he threw 30 picks, but he was the QB5.
Yeah.
And they've got Atlanta coming up. So like, Winston is legit going to be a top 12 QB play against Atlanta, assuming he's under center. We talked about Tua Tagovailoa last week. It didn't have a huge game, but he was still a top 15 quarterback. Had two touchdown passes for the second straight week. Broncos coming up next. Then you got the Jets and the Bengals. And he's not owned in enough leagues. He's a really talented guy. Some other quarterback options. And this is for the faint of heart, or not the faint of heart, and only in deep leagues. Alex Smith threw for nearly 400 yards. He didn't have a touchdown, but he's got the Bengals next. And then this is not being a homer because I don't even like Andy Dalton. Okay. But he got the Vikings coming up next. Game script could be in the Cowboys' favor. And if you're in a 2QB or super flex league, Andy Dalton's worth a look if you've got quarterback problems, a quarterback on a bye, whatever the case may be. Like, this is where we're at right now. This is where we're at right now. And the quarterback position, something has to happen with this position from a fantasy perspective moving forward, because I'm in leagues that are competitive where like a guy like Tua is still available. And it's just because you only start one and there's so many good ones. I feel like more and more leagues need to start going super flex. This way, quarterback's more valuable. It's the most valuable position in the NFL, right?
Yeah.
If you have a lousy quarterback, you're probably not winning games. So time will tell. But there's not a lot to like on the waiver wire this week. But Winston will likely be the top ad because he inherits. But I don't know where he is. Yeah, he hadn't done much the last couple of weeks.
Let's talk running backs then. Any good news at running back?
Yeah, Damian Harris is going to be a very highly added player. He's still out there in about 50-plus percent of leagues. He had a 41% touch share against the Ravens. And this is against the Ravens. Like, the thing about Harris, though, is that he doesn't do anything else. Like, if he doesn't give you, you know, 60 in a touchdown or 100 yards on the ground, he's not going to give you anything as a pass catcher.
Yeah.
But he's worth a look. They've got the Texans, so the matchup's right. And also Rex Burkhead. Burkhead had 2 touchdowns against the Ravens. He's got 3 touchdowns his last 2 games. James White's not rosterable anymore. He should be on the waiver wire every single league. They don't use him anymore. Rex Burkhead is more valuable. Nyheim Hines. Now, the Colts' backfield is a nightmare. 1 week to the next, I have no idea who the hell is getting the football. But you know what? When you're in a pinch, I'll roll the dice on a guy like Nyheim Hines that maybe it will be his week, right? Last week, 17 touches, 30% touch share, and 2 touchdowns, nearly 30 points against the Titans. And the Packers are a bad run defense. So Wayne Gallman. Now, this guy is Rodney Dangerfield this week, right? No respect. A touchdown in 4 straight games. Here's the problem. The Giants have a bye, but Devonta Freeman got put on IR. So grab him, stash him, hold him. In Miami, you ever hear of Salvon Ahmed? Okay?
Oh, yeah.
Now, I don't know if he's even going to be the ad, though, because if Matt Breida is 100%, he's going to start next week, right? So they've got the Broncos. So I would make sure Breida is owned, and if he's not, grab him. But Ahmed's going to be the number. Jordan Howard was a healthy scratch again. What the hell happened to that guy? That was an awful signing by Miami. So Breida and Ahmed. And then Kalen Ballage, who, God bless him, right? Dolphins stunk. Then ended up with the Jets. Fails a physical. Gets shipped back. Right? Cut. Then he signs with the practice squad in L.A., and suddenly he has fantasy value. Welcome to 2020. 23 touches, 102 yards, over 15 points against the Dolphins. Revenge game, right? Didn't we say that last week? And now you've got the Jets, and they stink. So he's got another revenge game. Right? He's got a revenge game against their doctors who failed him in a physical. But I don't know when Austin Eckler's coming back. He could be back soon, but Ballage is worth a look. Isn't that crazy? If you have Josh Jacobs, you have to have Devontae Booker. He's been good the last 2 weeks, and I'm not saying he's going to take the job because he's not, because Jacobs is awesome, but as a handcuff, Booker is worth an ad. Cam Akers led the Rams back in carries yesterday. Now, I don't know what that means moving forward, but it's interesting. So you can grab him as a stash, and then Tony Pollard's also a stash for me, for my beloved but pitiful Dallas Cowboys.
I do want to find the person who owned Kalen Ballage 2 weeks ago, who was just sitting on him all season.
No,
like that 0.1%.
Dude, I know.
Caleb,
right?
Ballage himself.
And that Chargers backfield, like, I thought Tremaine Pope was going to be the guy. I mean, he didn't do anything. He was invisible. And they stuck with Caleb Ballage. So they basically went with a practice squad player over Joshua Kelly, who has certainly fallen out of favor with Anthony Lynn. And Pope, who had gotten more touches 2 weeks ago, if you remember, than Joshua Kelly when Justin Jackson had that big game. So, man, it is what it is with some of these backfields.
All right, and then cooking at receiver here.
Yeah, we got a bunch. Michael Pittman Jr., man, 8 targets, 7 catches, nearly 20 fantasy points against Tennessee. In the last 2 weeks, leads all Colts wide receivers in snaps, routes run, targets, catches, fantasy points. You get the point. Mm-hmm. And Packers are coming up next, and both of their starting cornerbacks were out this week, so maybe that'll help his value moving forward. Yeah. We'll see with the health of those two players. Is Jacoby Myers? I mean, Dude, he played 57 snaps. And did you see that touchdown pass he had?
Beautiful.
Bro, that guy throws a prettier ball than Tim Tebow ever did. I'll tell you that right now.
That's not saying a whole lot.
But Tim Tebow's a quarterback. This guy's a wide receiver, right? So he leads all Patriots wide receivers in snaps, routes, run, targets. Since week 9, he's got a 41% target share. And you got the Texans coming up next. And so, like, I know he didn't do much as a pass catcher, but he had 5 catches. That's not bad. And Cam's throwing him ball a ton. In Green Bay, it all depends on what the status of Alan Lazard is. He was close. He's getting close. If he's the guy that comes off IR this week for Green Bay, he's the guy you want. But if not, Marquez Valdes-Scantling has 44 points in his last 2 games combined, right? I mean, geez Louise, I start in one of my leagues, it was either Jakeem Grant or Valdes-Scantling. I mean, they both played well. I ended up benching MVS. This is how deep the leagues I'm in. Some of them are ridiculous. But we'll talk about Grant, but MVS had another big game, and Aaron Rodgers is cooking with gas right now. Jalen Reagor for the Eagles, 7 targets, 4 catches. Not a huge stat line, but he ran 57 routes, which is the same as Travis Fulgham, who I fear is going to go the way of the dodo bird here very soon, because the Eagles are getting back to 100% in that passing game, although Fulgham's not done yet. But Reagor is worth a look. Tim Patrick and KJ Hamler, both in Denver. We talked about them both last week. Patrick was on his way to a good game until he got tossed, and Hamler had a ton of targets. Jakeem Grant, who I just mentioned, 5 targets, 4 catches, had a touchdown against the Lightning Bolts, and Preston Williams continues to be out. So Grant's worth a look. If you want to go deeper, Denzel Mims and Breshad Perriman, they stink. The Jets stink. They got the Chargers. I mean, the targets, right, are deep leagues. And then Cole Beasley was bananas good. 13 targets, 11 catches. Nearly 21 fantasy points against the Cardinals. And John Brown got hurt again. Now, the Bills are on a bye, but if you want to stash Cole Beasley, be my guest. He's been really good this year most of the time. He's had a couple of stinkers, but overall, Beasley's floor has been pretty solid.
Yeah, absolutely. And let's wrap it up. Tight ends, anything good out there?
The best guy out there is somebody who didn't play, and that's Dalton Schultz. So the Cowboys are getting Andy Dalton back. Schultz had 15 targets in his last 2 games. Like, that's a lot for a tight end, a ton. And you got the Vikings coming up. So I like Schultz as an ad. Jordan Reed's worth an ad too, but the Niners are on a bye. So if you need instant gratification, he's not going to do it for you. You could get it maybe with Logan Thomas, 6 targets, 66 yards, nearly 11 points against the Lions, 12 targets in his last 2 games. And Alex Smith does not like to throw the ball deep. I mean, J.D. McKissick had 15 targets. He had 29 targets in the last 2 games. That's crazy. What is he, Alvin Kamara? And they've got the Bengals coming up. And let me give a little love to a kicker. Okay. Tyler Bass. This dude is kicking Bass. All right. 54, 55, 58 yards, 18 fantasy points. Okay. The dude's got a leg cannon. He's had 14 plus points in 3 of his last 4 games. Like, Lamar Jackson's not that consistent. Okay. Buffalo's got a bye though, which stinks, because I'd be all over the Bass bandwagon. But I will tell you this, next week. All right. Next week, Tyler Bass will be mentioned in this spot. And also keep this in mind, guys. Like, I know people make jokes about kickers. Dude, if you can get a kicker who gives you 12 to 14 points a game, points is points. I don't care where they're coming from, right? I'm in a couple of leagues where Younghoe Koo is my kicker. I didn't drop him. He's too valuable. He's giving me like 12 to 14 every week. Like, I don't care. Like, people are starting Tremaine Pope, for Christ's sake, and Travis Homer. I need points, man. So I don't think that Koo's going to be available in most leagues. A lot of people held him, but he could be floating around out there. I'm telling you guys, man, like, make jokes. Like, Jason Sanders, I won league, and I'm down like 9 points. I got Dalvin tonight, so I feel okay about it. Jason Sanders right now is my 2nd highest scoring player on that roster. That I had Gio, he stunk. I had Duke Johnson, he stunk. I had Devontae Parker, he stunk. I had Dallas Goedert, he stunk. Somehow I'm still potentially going to win. But points are points, folks.
Kicker bandwagon. Get on it now.
Dude, they matter. Like, honestly, how many times have we seen Justin Tucker go for like 18 plus, or some kicker go for 18, 20 points, and that's the difference between winning and losing when one of your offensive skill positions goes in the tank? I mean, it happens. So I just want to score as many points as I possibly can. And Tyler Bass has been very good. So I love it that we just spent like 3 minutes on kickers. That's great.
And specifically Tyler Bass. Tyler Bass was awesome yesterday. I was hoping he was going to get a 60-yarder. Just keep on progressing. See how far
he
go
great,
out.
He was great, man. Yeah, he was awesome.
All right. Fabs, always a pleasure. You can catch Michael Fabiano every Monday on this show, but he's around all week, 7 days a week, 24 hours. Maybe not literally 24 hours, but SI.com/fantasy. Also, the SI Fantasy Podcast. I assume you're already subscribing to that, but if you're not, you should be. Fabs, always a pleasure. We will talk to you on Monday.
Yeah, and one quick note, Jim Mora is going to be on the podcast with us this week. So that's even more reason to go out and subscribe. Yeah.
Nice. Absolutely. All right, Jenny, welcome back. Hope you enjoyed your break there. We're kind of staying in the NFC West. We're going to Saints 49ers, and look, the 49ers hung around in this one. They made it much more difficult than you might have thought down in New Orleans, and they're doing it just absurdly shorthanded at this point. So credit to Kyle Shanahan and that staff. But what we have to talk about in this game is Drew Brees takes a big sack, actually was erased by kind of a pity flag, but takes a big sack, stays in the game, ends up not coming out for the second half, though. It's Jameis Winston to start the second half. The Saints are saying it's a rib injury. He's going in for MRI. We'll see what happens. We know the shoulder has been something of an issue the last couple of weeks. The win over Tampa last Sunday night kind of seemed to put that to bed, but now we're at a point where Drew Brees might miss some time. And the question is this Jameis Winston's offense? Is this Taysom Hill's offense? It was Winston in this game, but, you know, when you're switching mid-game, Taysom Hill's a much different offense. You know, if you're not prepared to go to that, maybe maybe they just consider it not an option. But I don't know. I don't know what this team's going to look like going forward, I guess, is what I'm getting at.
Yeah. First of all, back to the Brees injury itself just for a second and how kind of the information from that unfolded. There was like a very somber mood surrounding it. A rib injury is something that can keep you out a couple weeks. I guess it depends on how serious it is. But he was definitely taking a very serious tone. He said it's not something quite to this extent that I've experienced. And, you know, he said he didn't think it was a long-term thing, but it's a matter of how long it's going to be. So it certainly seemed like from those comments that it could be a significant chunk of time missed. They go with Winston. And I think you make a smart point here, Gary, that makes the most sense with the game plan that they entered the game with. But you think about all of the hype surrounding Taysom Hill this offseason and the fact that they applied a first-round tender to him and that the fact that he was branded as Brees' successor. Now's really the truth-telling part of things. Like, do they rebuild their offense around this Taysom Hill experiment that they spent so much time hyping up in the offseason, or do they still continue to use him as a changeup, which says a lot about their future plans, their post-Brees plans?
It's got to be Taysom Hill. It would be such cowardice to not do Taysom Hill at this point after everything that transpired this offseason. Just do it. Let's see it. Let's see what it's going to be.
I mean, I would like to see that because we were told over and over again this offseason that this guy could be it, you know, that they had to keep him around to plan for the post-Brees Saints era and that, you know, we saw how he was used in the playoffs in key situations and they trust him in key situations and then, you know, they didn't insert him in that game. So, yeah, I mean, But it's the same thing we thought last season, Gary. Like, they went with Bridgewater over Hill when Brees was out. So, you know, maybe they do stick with Winston.
I don't want to say I hope Drew Brees misses time. I hope maybe Drew Brees gets a couple of weeks off and then comes back fresh for January. That'd be a nice scenario for the Saints. But I'm really curious to see what they're going to do going forward here. Because, look, we all know Jameis Winston's issue is the turnovers. He had a very classic Jameis near turnover where he just like ignored a defender at the second level and almost got intercepted in this game. And it was just like, oh, right. I saw that 30 something times last year. Like, yeah. I don't know. I don't know if that's the guy they go forward with at this point, but we might find out. They host Atlanta next week, so we might get something of an answer at this point.
But it really does feel like this is, you know, the Breeze era is on its last legs. I mean, we knew going into the season that this could be the last year, but this really, I mean, it really feels like that, Gary.
All right, the NFC East, as the NFC East turns here, the Giants are back in it. The Giants beat the Eagles at home. Daniel Jones, for a second straight game, does not turn the ball over. I don't want to go too deep into this performance because there's just always so much to unpack with Daniel Jones. Made a ton of plays with his legs. I thought he was generally very sharp in this game, kind of like last week. You can see, though, he is not working late into the down, which he did, which generally is a good thing, but for him was becoming just he was on the wrong side of the risk reward just so many times over his first season and a half that I understand that he's it's been emphasized, like, do not go late into the down, do not hold on to the ball. But I thought he left a touchdown on the field because he didn't want to work late into the down. So they are definitely going a little more conservative with Daniel Jones. It is working. But I feel like the story in this one was the Eagles come back off the bye weekend. It's almost like they got worse. Like things got even shakier over the course of the bye week.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting. There was an ESPN report Sunday morning that the Eagles expected Wentz to come out of the bye, having analyzed and fixed a lot of mistakes, that he was pressing too hard, and that they thought he would play well, and it would silence the questions about his future. I thought that was a strange report, because it's just kind of one of those notions. Not really a piece of information or a fact. And yes. So why is someone on the team putting it out there? It was almost like they were like willing it into existence or trying to quiet some of the noise preemptively around Wentz, or not preemptively, I guess, but preemptively before this game. And then we didn't see the result of that. I mean, the defense was very ugly for the Eagles. It's not working. Like, you could see that, you know, that was a huge problem in this game. But what happened to the Wentz-Peterson partnership is just, and I still go back to, like, the team, the year that the Eagles won the Super Bowl, that locker room was just like a very special place. And I feel like the locker room was kind of like the engine. In the sense of, like, it felt like there were coaches that were players, and that players were correcting things, and that players were pointing the team in the right direction, and they were just kind of willing things to happen. And I wonder if, you know, maybe there were flaws in the team that just didn't show up that year because the veterans in the locker room were intent on not letting that happen.
It's obviously it's been a ton of changeover on the staff. Doug Peterson is still there, and Jim Schwartz is still there, but especially on the offensive side of the ball, just a lot of changeover there. Guys getting hired away, and a couple guys who they just chose not to retain this previous offseason. But you're right. I mean, look, if you were doing your power ranking of Carson Wentz performances in 2020, this might actually be middle of the pack. It wasn't disastrous. Yeah. It was just not good. But the weird thing about this game was everyone was terrible. I mean, Jason Kelce all of a sudden couldn't snap the ball. They couldn't get their protections right. Like you said, the defense just the defense has been maybe a little up and down this year, but it hasn't been as problematic as it was in this game. They had a ton of pre-snap penalties in the first half. They go 0-for-9 on third down. And I guess the one play that was sort of emblematic of it all, they had a 3rd-and-1 in the second quarter around midfield, and it was like, all right, well, they're going to get this one. They're going to keep this drive alive. And Wentz just gets tripped up by one of his teammates coming out from under center, and they end up in 4th-and-5, and they end up punting. And it's just like, I don't know. It's almost like if just Carson Wentz is the problem, that's not good, but okay, can you get your quarterback kind of on track? This just sort of felt like the entire team was the problem at this point.
Yeah. I have a weird theory. You see coaches come out of the Andy Reid tree and have success early on. Peterson, Nagy. But over time, like those teams, the offensive performances regressed. And you just wonder, like, coming fresh out of the Andy Reid offensive think tank, you have all of the ideas that are like in vogue right then and there, and that have been developed, and you seize the moment with all of these ideas, right? But what Andy Reid does is he continues to add and evolve and draw and redraw those ideas. And so when you're out of the Andy Reid think tank, do you then struggle to continue to adapt what you took from him in the subsequent seasons?
That is one of my favorite theories I've ever heard. That's
glad
really
you
good,
enjoy
Jay.
It, Gary.
It's like you're frozen in time when you leave Andy Reid. But it's a great point, and you've written about this, and folks should find that article, but we'll put it in the episode description. But Andy Reid evolves. Andy Reid is, you know, Andy Reid 2018, 2019 is not Andy Reid 2000. I don't know when he start there, 2002. Yeah, that's a great point. As far as the NFC East goes right now, and I have already proclaimed the Giants to be back in it. They're sitting at 3-7 right now. The Eagles are 3-5-1. We're setting aside the football team and the Cowboys for the time being, and frankly, probably for the rest of the season. But you would have thought the Eagles were kind of just going to move through and whatever, be a 7-8-1 playoff team or whatever it might be. The next five opponents for the Eagles have winning records. So even if they steal one of those games, and it would feel like a steal if they continue to play like they did on Sunday.
Yeah.
I mean, they might not get to 7-8-1. And we'll we'll see what the Giants can do. Giants have a much easier schedule going forward here and could realistically get to 7-9 if things go well. The defense has been good, and as we mentioned, Daniel Jones back to back games without turning the ball over. This is getting it's still terrible, but it's certainly interesting here in the NFC East at this point.
Yeah, the Giants are making it a little bit more interesting than we thought, I have to say.
I don't want to get too far ahead of ourselves, but if the Giants do win this division and go to the playoffs, like what of Dave Gettleman now? Everyone's
right.
Just sort of been like, all right, well, time to move on from Gettleman. And well, can you if they make the playoffs in year two of Daniel Jones? I don't know. That becomes a really annoying conversation we get to have all offseason. All right. Seven games to go. We are going to fire up the lightning-ish round, the fastest
Woo-hoo.
3 hours in sports. And Jenny, we should, you know, this is unfair to lightning round this game, but I think everyone was looking at Tua versus Herbert, and that would be the headliner mm-hmm. in this Dolphins Chargers game, and it wasn't. It was the Dolphins defense again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think it just underscores why this was an ideal situation for Tua to start playing in, because the defense has been playing so well that he wouldn't have to win games for them, as opposed to what you're seeing for other rookie quarterbacks, Burrow and Herbert, where there's been, you know, struggles around on both sides of the ball. Tua comes into a situation where this is a top five defense and they're making plays and they're putting the team in position to win.
Yeah, I mean, another game, 25 pass attempts for Tua in this one. Only has to throw for 169, and you know, it was fine. It was efficient. It was fine. But again, these cornerbacks, Byron Jones and Xavien Howard has reached the next level of this one. He has been all-pro caliber this year. And Keenan Allen and Mike Williams for the Chargers, just they did nothing in this game. They combined for five catches, 77 yards between them. And this is a whole lot of momentum going for Miami right now, and I hope you have a chance to talk about it on the Weak Side podcast this week. Let's go Bucks Panthers, where we all kind of wondered, okay, Bucks. I don't know what happens when the Bucks play the Saints. They just are a different team in the worst possible way. They come out in this one. They scored on all 10 of their drives, if you exclude the kneel downs by Blaine Gabbert to wrap this one out. I mean, this was a just utterly dominant offensive performance. 544 yards, 10 for 16 on third down. I mean, this was what they were supposed to be doing.
Yeah, and the narrative around Brady has always been when he has one game, bad game, he doesn't have two in a row. So he certainly proved that. But a big change was the defense, and they weren't good in the first half. But then in the second half, the Bucs defense really found its groove. I think Arian said there were some communication issues. But a big thing was they got a lot more pressure in the second half, and that seemed to be a big game changer. And they were far better on third down against the Panthers than they had been last week against the Saints.
Absolutely. A nice bounce back on both sides of the ball here. Steelers-Bengals, and not a surprise that the Steelers moved to 9-0, and then they have the Jaguars next week, so they'll probably get to 10-0 at this point. They do beat up on the Bengals at home. Roethlisberger, another efficient game. We'll see if the downfield stuff gets going in the second half of the season. But Joe Burrow, and he's been great, and he is going to be a star in this league. He has learned some tough lessons against those AFC North defenses, Pittsburgh and Baltimore at this point.
Yeah, definitely. There was a lot of talk about how Roethlisberger was good despite having not practiced this week. He was put on the reserve list after having a close contact, so he missed practice this week, threw four touchdowns. But Roethlisberger just generally doesn't practice all week. Like, I remember being there once on a Thursday, like late in the season, and I was like, why is Roethlisberger not out there? And they're like, no, like, this is normal. Like, he doesn't practice on Thursdays. So I don't think this was a huge change for him, and that, like, Tomlin has always kind of managed the veterans' reps in practice. But I will say one thing that I to keep an eye on, Gary, is the Steelers' run game is not what we expected.
Yeah, they have to get that going too. The pieces are there. You're just kind of waiting for it to click in the second half. And again, I think they might be better in the second half than they were in the first half, even if they end up dropping a game or two. And I don't know. I think they're going to be they're going to be in pretty good shape come January here as sort of the Chiefs' top challenger in the AFC. The Browns are right in. Browns are 6-3. And look, the Browns are better than the Texans. They should beat the Texans 9 out of 10 times when they play each other. But this was one of those games. They had to delay it. They started about a half hour late because just the wind and rain was whipping to just like hurricane levels in Cleveland. And so you get this sort of nasty wet field with the wind whipping, and that is just sort of an equalizer. And it frankly, look, we saw the Browns lose to the Raiders under conditions like that earlier this year, and it's just I'm sorry to say this, Browns fans, but your team has found ways to lose games like this over the last decade or so. But this was one they won, they won it pretty comfortably. And I thought this was a very encouraging win for a team that rightly has playoff aspirations at this point.
Yeah, and it also made me think what would have happened in the Browns-Raiders game if they had Chubb. That was a game that had similarly gross conditions, as you indicated. The Raiders won it on the ground. And the Browns in this game against the Texans, Chubb returned from injury, had more than 100 yards, and was a big part of the engine of the offense.
All right, Raiders, Broncos. Raiders move to 6-3 here, right in that AFC wildcard race. I mean, look, the Raiders are, this was one of their best defensive performances. They're also they're riding the run game like they wanted to coming into the year. Another 100-yard game here for Josh Jacobs. Derek Carr gets to be sort of more of a game manager type, which is fine. It's the way they want to do. There's something to be said for winning games in the style that you want to win games. And the Raiders are a team. People would look at their point differential when they're 5-3 at the midway point and kind of say, okay, this isn't sustainable. It's a team that hasn't gotten a lot of takeaways, though. There's no, usually when you see a team with a negative point differential and they have a good record, there's something weird going on. Like, you know, they're recovering two fumbles a game or something like that, or just some weird thing. The Raiders just don't really have that. They're just kind of drifting along at the same pace, and they're kind of in most games, and now they're sitting at 6-3.
Yeah, I think they're kind of indicative of the AFC, where there's like a couple really elite teams, and then there's a handful of other teams that are in the playoff mix, and the Raiders are in a good position to potentially make the playoffs. But it's, you don't see them in the same category as the Steelers and the Chiefs.
Yeah, and Drew Lock in this one just struggled again. He struggled the last couple of weeks. This time he didn't turn it on in the fourth quarter like he did the last couple of weeks. I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. There's still some season left, but I think the Broncos are going to end up in that quarterback conversation around draft time this spring. Let's see, two to go here. The Lions beat the football team, and we'll start with the positive here, and that's you know, Alex Smith. Mm-hmm. Look, first start since the gruesome injury, and certainly that's an accomplishment in and of itself. But this is a game that they trailed by 21 points with 20 minutes to go, and Alex Smith brought him back. And maybe the Lions aren't the most challenging team to come back against, but there's still something to be said for coming back and putting up that many points in an NFL game for a guy who, quite frankly, a lot of us thought we'd never see again.
Yeah, I mean, he's playing with drop foot, and he has a special leg brace that allows him to play with drop foot, and he almost won an NFL start as a quarterback. It's pretty remarkable. But yeah, the Lions, you know, nearly blowing this 24-3 lead just continues to reflect that this Lions team has no identity, and Patricia has very clearly taken them backwards from the Jim Caldwell era.
Matthew Stafford, who's so, I just want to say this in Matthew Stafford's defense. I think he's been, I think he's underrated. I think he's been just a great, great quarterback over the last decade. The guy's so banged up. He injures his thumb in this one, and it's like, okay, well, we're up 3 touchdowns on Washington with 20 minutes to go. I can probably take it easy from here on in. And no, the defense can't hold on to the lead. So Stafford has to go back out, and they end up. I mean, this last sort of game-winning field goal drive ends up being, they get the ball with 16 seconds left. Chase Young gives them a sort of a foolish roughing the passer penalty to move it along. But you know, Stafford has to hit 2 quick hit completions here, and then Matt Prater from 59 yards to win it. But Matthew Stafford just can't get like a moment of peace in Detroit here.
Yeah, that's a good description, Gary.
Packers and Jaguars, last one. This was another windy game here in Lambeau. And look, Jaguars were rightfully 2 touchdown underdogs in this one. They do it with special teams, and they just sort of hung around, and they ended up taking advantage of a couple Packers turnovers as well to make this one close. The Packers won 24-20. So this counts as a win for them, even if it didn't feel like a very impressive performance.
It didn't feel like an impressive performance, especially when you have the head coach, Matt LaFleur, calling the game performance afterwards disturbing. It was disturbing that they are playing like this, low energy at home in Lambeau Field. And it's clearly something that they have to correct after the previous game against the Vikings, and then to follow it up with this performance against the Jaguars, who are starting a rookie quarterback.
Yeah, it was. Packers had 3 takeaways on the season coming to this one, and they end up. Rodgers throws an interception. Devontae Adams loses a fumble after a catch. But Jaguars special teams. It was. Keelan Cole had a 91-yard punt return. They had. Logan Cook was the real star in this game. He had pinned the Packers inside their own 10 4 times. It was everything you would dream it would be if you were a Jaguars fan, except for the win, I guess. Just play him close. That's all you want. Stay in the Trevor Lawrence Derby here. They're still sitting in the second position. That's going to do it for this week. Jenny, thanks for joining us. I'm not even going to call you a fill-in, because I think you're going to be here pretty consistently from here until Super Bowl time.
Well, glad to be back, Gary. Always a pleasure.
The MMQB Monday Morning NFL Podcast is Jenny Vrentis and me, Gary Gramling. We are produced by Shelby Royston. SI's executive producer of podcasts is Scott Brody. Ben Eagle is director of editorial projects and product. Mark Ravick is emeritus editor of the MMQB. Andy Benoit is the founder of the MMQB NFL Podcast. Please subscribe to this feed, as well as all the feeds for the MMQB podcast. That's the Weekside podcast featuring Jenny and Connor Orr, the Albert Breer Show, which features Albert Breer. They're all for free on Apple Podcasts. And once you do subscribe, leave a rating and review for all of them. It really does help other people find the shows, which are also available on Spotify, radio.com, Stitcher, SI.com, and wherever else you listen to podcasts.